You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Well, I'm delighted to reconvene our session following up on our discussions of this morning, the framing of the issue of the, if you will, the sort of tensions between individual, effective, transformational leadership on the one hand and the constraints of the era of politics in which we live and what the sort of what the possibilities is. Is Speaker Boehner a waif amid forces within his Republican conference, and is that why we're coming to the brink? Is there, even in this environment, opportunities for individuals, be they party leaders or committee chairs or presidents, to take actions that could create new opportunities that we do not see naturally? That's what we're going to talk about, and we have a congressional scholar and two superb reporters on Congress and American politics more broadly who've been covering this story, such as it is. And Sarah Bender, my colleague on my right here, is a senior fellow at Brookings, as well as a professor at George Washington University. She has her most recent book is called "Advice and Dissent: The Struggle to Shape the Federal Judiciary." Even more relevant, the book before that was "Stalemate: Causes and Consequences of Legislative Gridlock." Sarah and I are together going to draw on all of your wisdom to write a paper on this very question, sort of what's the room for leadership in this environment. She's going to go first. Then we're going to turn to David Wellner, who's become the NPR reporter that I always look for and listen to tell me what the latest dysfunction of the United States Senate is and whether and if we can do anything about it. As soon as he speaks, you will feel you're in the presence of a friend, a familiar voice that that he and his colleagues have brought to us over the years. One of the great pleasures I had was chairing a committee, the Kerry McWilliams Award Committee of the American Political Science Association, which gives awards to individual journalists. And when I was chair, the award was given to NPR as an organization. I guess I'm showing my hand on the issue of funding of NPR, but there you go. Transparency is in these days. And to my left is a dear friend and marvelous reporter, Janet Hook, who I remember from her days at CQ, then on to the LA Times, and now most recently reporting and writing for the Wall Street Journal. A wonderful team I bring to you, and Sarah's going to kick us off.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much, Tom. Thanks for including me. I thought I'd start us off by talking a bit about the challenges of legislating and leading in a Congress in a period of pretty intense partisan polarization. In other words, how the dickens did we get into this mess, and will strong leaders get us out of it? And in the absence of that question for several more hours, I thought instead I would just offer two ways of thinking about that particular question. First, I want to talk a little bit about the barriers to legislative compromise that extend beyond partisanship. And second, just think very explicitly about the constraints that congressional leaders face, or the constraints on strong leadership in Congress. So first, just in terms of barriers to congressional problem solving, I want us to think just a little bit about electoral constraints, second about partisan constraints, and then third about institutional constraints. First, in terms of electoral forces, we say it over and over, but it rings true, I think, every time we say it, which is that members of Congress are single-minded seekers of re-election. That is, no matter what policy goals, political goals, or other power goals they may have or they may want to achieve, right, re-election is the proximate goal. It's the thing you have to do first in order to pursue any of these other goals. You can't achieve those other goals without first getting re-elected. And that re-election motive, we think, shapes, right, all of their behavior. What do we mean really by that? It means that legislators see major policy choices through the eyes of their constituents, right? Whether it's the question of how or whether to bail out the financial sector, whether it's the question of regulating greenhouse emissions, or, of course, whether or not to fund and on what terms to fund the federal government for even 6 months. Why is that important? No matter the level-headedness and the hard work of party leaders, they have to convince rank-and-file members that what's in the party's collective interest, or, God forbid, what's in the nation's general welfare, is simultaneously in that member's individual electoral interest. Leaders can't just command loyalty from their rank-and-file. Think about the implications here for Speaker Boehner, right? Early on in the battle over the budget, Speaker Boehner and the leadership of the House Appropriations Committee proposed a fairly moderate set of spending cuts relative to where they've come now. A group of freshmen, a group of conservatives said, no, right, that's insufficient for given our campaign promises. Conservatives were far more interested in living up to those campaign promises, even if it risked allowing Democrats potentially to brand those Republicans as ideologues and then blame them for a shutdown. There's no getting past these electoral barriers unless your own rank and file see the party's interests as synonymous with their own. And I think that's, well, I'm sure we'll come back to that's part of the dilemma here, I think, for the speaker, right? How to both please the base of his party and their own electoral interests, and well as to think about the party's reputation or brand name in Washington, given the events of last week. So first, I think we need to keep in mind these electoral barriers. Second, in terms of other barriers, this partisanship or indelible partisan polarization. By every measure we have, whether it's roll call or other based measures, partisan polarization has climbed steadily and shows very little sign of abating. What is debilitating about partisan polarization is that it reflects more than just policy disagreement, more than ideological disagreement, right? Certainly it represents policy differences between the two political parties, right? But it also represents political differences, right? That increased incentive to disagree with the other team just because it's the other team or the other party, right? That partisan team play amplifies ideological disagreements, right? So we have both policy disagreement and, if you think about it, sort of strategic disagreement, an incentive simply to disagree, right? And clearly some of this comes up in what's going on with this game of chicken over the spending bill to avoid the shutdown, right? Certainly we think that the sheer numbers can be compromised, right? And yes, these are difficult compromises to reach, but in the end it's dollars and cents. But if there's a wing of the conservatives in the House, and if the speaker wants to remain speaker, right, they may have a political incentive not to compromise. Again, why do we care about these partisan dynamics? Clearly we think it raises the barriers to legislating and raises the barriers for leaders trying to reach compromises, right? The narrower question about the rest of the federal funding for 6 months, let alone these broader questions about the debt limit, about debt, about deficits, and so forth. And we should think, if we look carefully, that this partisan disagreement, it tends to spill over into issues that aren't strictly red and blue policy issues on themselves. So the foreclosure crisis, for instance, right, if you look at the extent of foreclosures across the country, it hits red districts, Republican districts, it hits blue Democratic districts, and yet there's a fair amount of polarization between the parties, spills over and makes the foreclosure crisis almost impossible to solve. So first, electoral barriers, second, partisan barriers, and third, final barrier here is simply sort of institutional dysfunction. That is, we think we have pretty good evidence that this balance of majority rule and minority rights is off kilter, and it's off kilter in the two chambers in different ways. Typically in the House, with the big caveat of how the spending bill, H.R. 1, was debated with wide open amendment process, typically in the House, the balance is tilted far to the right, to the rights of the majority to control the agenda, with the minority party given very little stake and opportunity to participate. Typically in the Senate, we think that the balance is tilted too far in the other direction, right, tilted toward the interests of the minority to block the majority. granted in the Senate the beginning of the year. We had a bit of a procedural detente, right? We had what we've been calling the Reid-McConnell handshake between the majority and minority leader, right? But even that agreement to allow a more open, more freedom of senators to offer amendments on the floor, right, without being closed down by the majority leader, even that agreement, it hasn't produced a more collegial body, right? It seems to have created opportunities for more position taking, but not really problem solving, right? Think about the votes that were taken on the, right, there was a Senate vote on H.R. 1 on the spending bill, but there was no deliberation over the bill. There was no debate over the bill. There were votes this week on greenhouse emissions, right, and whether EPA should be able to regulate it. And I think taking those votes were important for the Democrats to stake out their positions, right, to show the extent of agreement on these policy riders. But, right, simply because we had more opportunities to offer amendments doesn't seem to have solved the problem of creating an institution where they actually meet and try to have a meeting of the minds. Strikes me these three factors, of course, are coming home to roost, right? The moment of reckoning over the budget due to the action-forcing deadlines, right? And clearly there'll be more action-forcing deadlines coming this year. Again, why should we care about these barriers? Collectively, they really complicate the exercise of leadership, right? It's not just a matter of sitting down at the White House time after time after time this week or the last 2 days. And it's not just a matter of meeting and splitting the difference, right? Leaders have an electoral interest of their own members in mind, right? They often have a strategic reason to disagree with the other party, even in face of common gains, right, and common ground that may be visible. So if that's not depressing enough, just a few words to think about more explicitly about the constraints that these leaders find themselves in. Political scientists, students of Congress in particular, have thought and written quite a bit over the decades about leadership power and about leadership style. We've seen a fair amount of variation over time, both in how leaders, the degree of control leaders have and the style with which they run their chambers, right? From the czars of the early 20th century to the sort of bargainer and listener of Sam Rayburn to the more sort of crash and burn style of Newt Gingrich. But despite that diversity of leaders and leadership style, political scientists typically have argued that power and style don't stem from the personal characteristics or the personal traits of the leaders themselves, right? Thus, if we're frustrated with leadership in the Senate, for instance, we can't just say that we need a more forceful majority leader, right? Instead, we tend to argue that leadership is contextual, by which we mean that leaders are constrained by the institutional context, right, the rules and tools available, and the electoral context, right, the diversity or unity of views within their congressional parties. So when we see parties internally cohesive and ideologically opposed to one another, right, we're likely to see under those conditions, right, more strong, effective leadership, right, rank-and-file members willing to empower leaders to work on their behalf, okay? And we can all come up with examples of where we've seen that. But when the majority is split internally, say Democrats mid-20th century, majority will have very little appetite for empowering their leaders, right? You can't trust that the leader's interests are going to be in your own individual interests if there's a diversity of policy views within your conference, right? Of course, the irony is if you have strong, cohesive parties, you don't need, right, proactive leaders quite as much. Everybody is largely in agreement on policy grounds. You need strong stewards, right? You need someone to manage the name brand of the party and build coalitions on behalf of those positions, right? It's in face of internal disagreements that you need leadership to encourage compromise on acceptable solutions. But if leaders are only as strong as their parties want them to be, you're in a bit, I think, of a conundrum. The Boehner example, again, to wrap up, I think is instructive. There seem to be elements of strong divisions in that conference, at least is what emerged if you're looking at the votes that occurred on H.R. 1, where divisions weren't just between Democrats and Republicans on spending. They were across, and not just freshmen versus more senior members, right? It's really sort of ideological divisions between the far right and the more moderate elements of the Republican conference. But Boehner's, right, well, the criticism of him this week is that he's been moving the goalpost, right, so that it's hard to reach an agreement. But I think the moving of the goalpost in part reflects the ambiguity, right, of what's acceptable to a majority of his conference. Again, not just the Tea Party, not just the freshmen, but more what's acceptable to more conservative elements of his party. Boehner doesn't want to get out ahead of his conference, probably not least because the speaker in waiting is waiting in the wings. Okay, where does that leave us? I think there's often this implicit, if not explicit, criticism of congressional leaders for failing to get us out of the mess, right? Why can't they just bring along their parties to take tough votes to solve these long and short-term problems? I think we need to keep in mind the front and center, right, the context in which these leaders operate, right, and these very real constraints under which they labor. And labor they do this week. Okay.
Thank you, Sarah. That's a wonderful start to our discussion. David.
Good morning. I guess I should preface this saying that I came to Washington about 10 years ago to cover Congress. But I had a background actually as a foreign correspondent. I spent many years in Latin America covering many different governments there. And I had the experience of covering situations where impasses in their legislatures led not to compromise, but it led to military interventions and a whole new government. So I'm watching the drama unfolding today and thinking it could be worse. Now, this week I cover mainly the Senate, so I watch Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell get up every morning and give their speech of the day. And Harry Reid this week has been repeatedly mentioning Henry Clay, who is known as the Great Compromiser. And something that Clay said was, all legislation is founded on the principle of mutual concession. And so Reid has been saying, of course, this is what we need. It's not even concession so much, it has to be mutual. Clearly, this is a situation where the Democrats want the government to stay open. It would be a huge embarrassment for Obama to have this happen on his watch. And yet, there's also a feeling that Republicans have a real stake in keeping it open, too, since it turned out so badly for them last time. I look at this, and I think that in some ways this encapsulates the paradox of what this Congress is. The nature of this two-party system and the structure we have in Congress is adversarial. That's our idea of getting good policy, good law, is to fight it out first and then reach some kind of a conclusion. But to get that kind of a conclusion, you have to have either a supermajority and override the minority, or you have to have some degree of bipartisanship, people willing to cross the aisle and work with people on the other side to get the majority needed to pass things. Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa is fond of saying that he's never gotten anything done of significance in the Senate without a Democratic co-sponsor. It just doesn't happen. Now, at the same time, making deals or making concessions is a tricky business as well, because it raises questions about your political loyalty. I mean, you're called a Republican in name only if you side with the Democrats on something, or a Democrat in name only, vice versa. Your personal integrity is questioned. You're seen as a sellout or wishy-washy. These are not the kinds of labels that politicians like to have. The idea that the number one job of a lawmaker is to hang on to his or her job is one that we've had for many years. I think we're in a little bit different territory with this new Congress, especially with 87 new Republicans in the House. Many of them come sort of with a political kamikaze attitude of that, hey, if I don't get reelected in 2 years, big deal. I came here to change Washington. And there isn't the kind of self-preservation instinct necessarily that you would expect from other Congresses. At the same time, that may be their strategy for self-preservation, because their constituency wants them to stick to their principles, stick to the $61 billion that they voted for in February, after all, and why can't the Senate understand that that's the number that it has to be? I mean, that's the kind of mentality that I think Boehner is dealing with right now. I think also the Congress is a kind of a mirror of this polarized nation. But there's also, I mean, it's not just that political passions are so far apart on many issues. I think we've also had a kind of a demographic segregation politically in this country. People move to areas where they find fellow-minded inhabitants. The schools that they send their kids to, the churches they go to, the politicians who represent them. There's been much more of a kind of separation of political inclinations that's gone on, and the people who end up representing these people feel a lot more like they have to stick to purity than to making deals with opposition. I mean, there's gerrymandering that's protected many members of Congress, but there's also just this phenomenon of people not feeling like their constituents are looking for them to compromise that much. You don't have people out on the ramparts agitating for moderation. I mean, it's the people who are passionate about things who often drive the political process, especially in the primaries. And I think right now the drama that we're seeing playing out today seems to be a consequence of that also, of that many politicians feel that they're in Washington because of those passionate people who sent them, who don't want them to compromise. And that's a really tricky position for Boehner, because his party in many ways set out a kind of a maximalist position with the number they came up with for this half-year budget. And to come down from that number, even though Democrats started out saying that they didn't think that there should be anything cut. They said, let's just stick with last year's budget and we'll figure out a new one when we have the FY12 debate. Even though Democrats have come up, they say, more than halfway to that $61 billion number, they're not dealing with a group of people, at least many Republicans, who feel like anything much less than $61 billion is acceptable. And in some ways, I think this is the first big political test in Washington of the clout of the Tea Party-backed members of Congress. They haven't had this kind of a contest before, so their credibility in many ways is on the line. For them, of course, that credibility may matter more than the federal government staying open for a few days, or who knows how long this may go on if it does shut down. And that's a problem for Boehner to try to get a deal. Boehner, of course, was in Congress during the last shutdown and has, I'm sure, some regret about how things turned out for Republicans back then. It's a problem for Harry Reid and President Obama dealing with somebody who they know has to be able to show those members who are so passionate about this that Republicans came out on top in this still. I mean, I don't know quite what they can come up with that will make both sides feel like they won something. I mean, Democrats already feel like they've given away much more than they ever thought they would. But this is a problem, I think, of salesmanship right now. And we were just seeing that they're reporting that there is a deal. Now, I'm curious to find out what the contours of that are going to be. Both Janet and I have had a chance to watch other big fights go on in Congress over other issues. The whole debate over the healthcare legislation was a good example, I thought, of what happens when you have a very big majority in Congress, in both chambers, as the Democrats did. They have an issue that they've long wanted to push forward since the early 90s, at least, of overhauling the healthcare system. And it's not an issue that Republicans were necessarily clamoring to take up themselves. And And they, especially in the Senate, there was an effort made at a committee level, and I think that at the committee level, that's where compromises often get done because people know each other. From both parties, they spend a lot of time together. There's much more trust in those committee rooms than there is out in the Senate chamber. And there was an effort in the HELP committee to have amendments, amendments were offered. Most of the Republican ones were rejected. And then they went ahead and they marked up their bill and they said, okay, let's bring it out to the floor. The Finance Committee, on the other hand, which Max Baucus chaired at the time, and Grassley was the top Republican on, decided that they were going to go the consensus route. They were not going to push for a final version in their committee of this bill until they had some kind of an agreement, at least with some Republicans on the committee, for moving a bill forward. The months started to drag on. There were all the protests in August against the health care bill, and many Democrats began to think that instead of seeking consensus, these committee Republicans were seeking to stall. And by late September, Baucus basically pulled the plug and he said, okay, enough already. We're going to take this to a vote. I think they got one Republican, Olympia Snowe, to vote for it. But what they got in the end was a bill that really had only the imprimatur of Democrats on it. And it ended up being this fight of getting all the Democrats to agree, getting a consensus among them, because there were 60 in the Senate chamber at that time, or 60 in their caucus. And they got it through, but what they ended up with was legislation that no Republican felt any loyalty to. They had no skin in that game, and it's become sort of a whipping boy for them ever since. In some ways, this is similar to what happened with the Bush tax cuts in the early years of the century, where you had a very evenly split Senate. It was 50-50. Again, there was the need to pick up some Democratic support. There were some Democrats who came over, but it was never much of a consensus between the two parties that they should go forward with these tax cuts. And for years, that was the bete noir for many Democrats. The war in Iraq, I think there was more consensus on. It divided Democrats. But that, too, was something that they came back at again and again and said this was poor judgment. I mean, I think that it all suggests that getting consensus behind major social policy is good to do if you want that policy to prosper. I think that the nature of Congress is that the rules of Congress are basically conservative in the sense that they accommodate the status quo more than they accommodate change, especially in the Senate chamber. And I think it's partly because the rules force opposite sides to work with each other if something's going to get done. Some things are getting done even now. This group of six in the Senate, there are three Republicans and three Democrats who worked on the Deficit Reduction Commission. I think that commission's work is actually fruitful in the sense that it's led to the further work of this group who are trying to get some kind of a grand bargain in Congress. It's become a kind of a reference point for a lot of other efforts to work out the debt crisis. And so you see that there is, I don't know if you would call it compromise, I would call it maybe more bipartisanship that's going on, but there's a recognition that unless the two sides work together on something like this, it's not going to get done. I don't know how today's going to end. I think this is sort of the test of whether it's really possible to find common ground, especially with House Republicans. But I think this is what Congress is about. It's about conflict, about disagreement, But it's also about that unless you get some degree of agreement, in the end, nothing moves forward.
Thank you, David. I think it's way too premature to have an agreement. I mean, it's only 5 after 11. Jana, we didn't expect this to happen until the very last moment, right?
Yeah. Well, if David is allowed to pull out his BlackBerry, he can probably check those and find out whether I got an early bulletin that somebody had reported that there was a deal. And the thing that's been funny about this whole negotiation is they're really, having gotten this far, there really isn't much incentive for either side to kind of close the deal a minute before they have to. And when they have to, I don't know. It probably has something to do with writing bills and getting another quick fix CR through. Because in the end, this negotiation, like many negotiations, the end game, it's very important for both sides to shape the perception of what the product is, how much each side has given. And David's right. The Democrats do feel that they have already given a lot more than the Republicans, and they are right. They have given, I think they've moved much farther, and I think that's a tribute in part to how strong a hand Boehner has, and that in turn is a tribute to how forceful his freshman class and conservative wing has been. But before I get to today, I just wanted to say that, you know, this general discussion about leadership, whenever I hear people talking about, you know, leadership in Congress, you know, are there any strong leaders, whatever happened to all the strong leaders, I'm reminded of something that I think I first heard from Tom Foley when he was Speaker, not to date myself, but I've heard it from other people too, but the point is it goes back as far as when Tom Foley was Speaker. He said, you know, we don't have a problem with leadership, we have a problem with followership.
Right.
You know, that it's all very well and good to have a strong leader who says, you know, we really must address the Social Security crisis, but if he turns around and there's nobody following him, he can't. So the job of a leader in Congress, for as long as I've been covering it, hasn't been, you know, kind of leading the charge so much as marshaling the troops and bringing people along, finding coalitions, building coalitions. But the thing that's really different and takes that challenge to a different order of magnitude, I think, in this Congress for Boehner among the Republicans, is the difference in who the followers are. And it's not just that they're conservative and anti-Washington and anti-establishment. It's that they've been elected feeling like they owe nothing to the leadership. I mean, they don't owe anything to anybody. They are here as citizen-led legislatures, or they don't. And at that point, it's a very different freshman class of conservative, anti-Washington, anti-establishment Republicans than were elected in 1994. A lot of those felt like they owed their election to Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich was very involved in recruiting those candidates. He distributed campaign tapes from his PAC called GOPAC. He was very involved in the election of the freshman class that became the majority that elected him Speaker. So he had a stronger hand with his rank and file than Boehner does now because they felt they owed something to him. And there's a little bit of that also, now I'm really stretching, to say in the class of Republicans elected in 1980 on Reagan's coattails, we called them Reagan robots because they felt like they owed their election to Ronald Reagan. So I don't know. Reagan and Gingrich are probably also stronger leaders than John Boehner is in their leadership style, but their followers are just, his followers are just really different. That said, you know, another point of contrast that I'm thinking about in the past is we have this kind of conventional idea about leadership and, you know, how deals are done in Washington. And you could think that the situation right now is classic. You know, the Democrats wanted to freeze spending at 2010 levels, and the Republicans wanted to cut it to 2008 levels. Well, duh, you know, you come to a compromise in the middle. The leaders kind of work out the deal in a closed room, and they go back to their followers, and then they vote for it. And that isn't the way it's working out now for a variety of reasons, but it also didn't work out when they did it that way in the early 1990s. There was a big budget deal that was cut at, Camp David. And they went back to the House, and it was rejected because of a coalition of liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans.
Andrews Air Force Base, was it?
Is that what I said? No.
No, okay. You said Camp David.
Okay, Andrews Air Force Base. You know, one of those secret places. Anyway, so the point is that, you know, followers and leaders, and you know, it was a challenge on a lot of these budget issues are very hard, and they kind of splinter parties in different ways. So, and I also think that looking at the current leadership right now, I think the challenges facing Boehner and Harry Reid now in the current CR compared to the issues ahead of them, I hate to say it, but this is the easy part. I mean, this is really, to be honest with you, you know, this conventional compromise that I just described to you, well, that is actually what's happening. Left, right, center, deal in the room, go out and sell it. I mean, that's kind of what's happening. It's just, it looks so much harder. And but the place where you need strong leadership in the form of leaders getting their followers to do something they don't want to do, that's what comes up when they turn to the broader deficit reduction issues. It's like here we're talking, I think it was Dick Durbin who said that the CR working out a compromise on just straight spending is like algebra. Working out a deal on entitlements and the bigger issues is like advanced calculus. And I think that that's where you need not just strong leadership, but creative leadership. And, I don't know whether you could say right now that these leaders are less up to it than leaders in the past. I think those kind of comparisons are kind of hard to make. But one of the biggest differences I've noticed in the functions and demands of congressional leaders over the years I've been covering Congress is how much more emphasis there is now on the leaders as the carriers of a message that they're rather than as, you know, the leaders of a party that's, you know, kind of a functioning unit within a legislative body. I mean, they are speaking, these congressional leaders, more so in the past, speak to the public, to their adversaries, and less sort of internally. I mean, there used to be this sense of there being an inside game and an outside game on any given issue, that leaders who want to accomplish something on, say, healthcare, you know, Ted Kennedy is a good example. You know, he really knows how to cut deals and write legislation, and others, though Kennedy was also good at the outside game. There were just two faces of every legislative battle. But this CR debate has been a classic of, you know, the inside game was almost invisible in part because the negotiations have been so closely held. But the outside game, you know, what we heard from the leaders every day, I mean, you couldn't tell what its relationship was to the reality of what was being negotiated. And part of it was the people who knew weren't talking and the people who were talking didn't know. So, I mean, you just had, or they knew what, anyway, it was just, it's been a very, very hard thing to cover as a reporter. You know, you feel like every day, you know, what's happened? I don't know. Chuck Schumer said this, Eric Cantor said that, therefore what? What do my readers need to know? I don't know whether, in the Senate in particular, David will probably know this as well as anybody, there's this sort of tension and contrast between the leadership of Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer, whereas Chuck Schumer's main mission is presenting a Democratic message every day. And one thing, and Harry Reid has a lot more power over what actually is getting done in those negotiations, but a carrier of a message, he's not. You know, he's just sort of, he's kind of a more of an old school leader. And people, you know, sometimes ask me, how did Harry Reid ever get to be Senate Democratic leader? And my answer is the old fashioned way. He did, you know, a lot of favors for members. He was on the Appropriations Committee. He kind of, his Democrats love the guy. You know, he just doesn't, you know, kind of project as loudly as Chuck Schumer. Let's put it that way. And if I could just comment on one thing that, that David was mentioning that I thought was really interesting about this spending debate being the first big test of the Tea Party and their influence in Congress. I think their influence isn't going to be measured by how many of them vote for the bill. I think their influence has already been very strongly felt. And I think that Boehner's skill in the compromise may be measured in his ability to, you know, allow the Tea Party people to vote against the bill because it's not $61 billion and it's not $100 billion and yet still pass it with a lot of Republicans. So we'll find that out. Not today. They won't vote on anything today, but there'll probably be a deal by the end of the day.
No. They could vote on a stopgap measure just right to keep things going until early next week.
Yes.
Presumably would this time a straight, clean 4 days, 5 days, no riders, no more deficit reduction?
That is what the Senate Democrats are going to try to substitute for the stopgap measure that the House passed yesterday that cuts $12 billion in a week and extends defense funding through September and has this rider on it, barring local funds being used for abortion in Washington, D.C. That would be replaced by something saying just we'll just keep spending as we have been until we get this deal signed up. But I think that if there is a deal and there's the realization that the negotiations are over, there would probably be more willingness by Republicans to go along with that because it would be saying, yes, we may not cut the whatever the number is, the $35 billion in the next week, but it will be cut over the remainder of the fiscal year. But I guess if that happens, it's going to happen late today. The House is standing by. I think they've got some work to do that they would have done next week otherwise. But Congress is the kind of place, I see Senator Bennett just came in, he knows well, where things don't happen until they have to. I guess midnight is the witching hour today.
Janet, thank you. Thank you very much. Let's engage in just a little sort of counterfactual speculation. This morning earlier, Dan Glickman wondered out loud whether things would have been different. There would have been less of a vacuum, more of an opportunity for the more orderly management of cleaning up this fiscal year and moving to the next if President Obama had taken hold of Smith, Simpson-Bowles-Simpson agreement and not endorsed it, but said, I want it put into legislative language and I want you all to go to work on it. I see some strong points, some weak points, but this is a basis. So my question to you is, can you imagine any action taken by any leader that could have or would, say, on debt ceiling and moving ahead, produce a better outcome? That's just think Obama, think Reid during the lame duck. Could he have made a compromise to avoid the filibuster on the continuing resolution that would have carried through the year, or were the Republicans absolutely committed to having this in play? Is there anything Boehner could have done differently, or has he done about all he could do as you describe the position and perceptions and sentiment of the Tea Partiers? Who'd like to take a crack at that? Sarah?
I'll just take the small piece of the last part, and then we'll come back to the first Simpson-Bowles part. I think the predicament back, I guess it was the beginning of December, where the CR finally fell apart, they weren't at 60 votes.
Yeah,
and
it was 59,
think they were,
right.
And I think they had lost.
Oh, they lost, right.
Well, I don't think they were going to get to 60 votes.
Yeah.
And I'll defer to Senator Bennett on whether 60 would have been in reach and what Democrats would have had to have compromised. But I don't think there was this incentive for the Democrats. In retrospect, yes, right? But I think if they thought they could get it, they would have made the compromises necessary to get to 60. But clearly, I think Republicans understood their increased leverage come January, and I think that induced their resistance to giving the votes to get to 60. On the question of the counterfactual, had Obama gone out and really wholeheartedly embraced the Simpson-Bowles recommendations, this is sort of an empirical cop-out to the answer, but they were still faced with the problem of having to do the spending bill for the rest of 2011. And to some extent, sure, it might have provided a counterpoint to the Paul Ryan budget that came out, an entitlement plan that came out this week, but I don't think anything necessarily would have played out differently for the current mess that they're in.
Okay.
Yeah, I think what the Simpson-Bowles recommendations were for a much bigger budget, a 10-year budget, not for, at that point, a 7 or 8 month stopgap,
right.
are filling out the rest of the fiscal year budget. And so it's really the FY12 budget that we saw Paul Ryan introduce this week. Now, that's the place where you could take those recommendations and have them as a counterpoint, possibly, to what he's recommended. And I think that's actually what's happening. And this group of six that is trying to come up with a grand bargain that would not be only for dealing with FY12 budget, but also looking at the fact that the debt ceiling will have to be raised by July or so, or there's going to be, you know, some kind of a default. They're looking at those deadlines and those exigencies as the way to push other people in Congress to come together on this. We have 64 senators, 32 from each party, who have essentially endorsed that effort in a letter that came out last week or the week before. So it looks like there's a possibility for traction with that. You know, my feeling about a budget has always been that in some ways it's a bit of smoke and mirrors, because they come out with a budget. It's supposedly a 10-year budget. It's really only for the next year. It's for the appropriations bills for the coming year. And the rest of it is all kind of wishful thinking, possibly, because they come out the following year with another 10-year budget. It's important when you have budget reconciliation and you want to have tax cuts or raises, things like that. But I think that, you know, the fact that Democrats didn't pass a budget last year, that's hardly unprecedented. That's happened lots of times that they haven't passed, that Congress has not passed a budget, and they end up doing these big omnibus spending bills towards the end of the year to sort of muddle through. But I think that what the budget does do is it forces a debate about priorities. And really, I think the central debate in Congress right now is, what is the proper role of the federal government? And that's at the bottom what we're probably going to see debated in the coming months.
Janet, I think Glickman's point was that if Obama would have sort of put that on the table, even though it didn't deal directly with this fiscal year's battle, it would have helped to sort of trivialize the objective and the stakes involved and might have made it easier to resolve. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I'm fishing for examples of where, in this context, under these circumstances, with all the dynamics that our panelists have outlined that constrain a leadership, I'm looking for opportunities that we could have imagined had someone done this or that. Had Paul Ryan put on the table a proposal that wasn't as extreme and radical a vision of the world, but something different, might that have made a difference in enticing Democrats into a serious discussion on the longer-term budget? But you may have other examples, and maybe the answer is no.
Well, first of all, I got to tell you, Tom, with all due respect, I hate that kind of question. You know, what if?
Yeah.
You know, we just don't know. And I'll tell you. I'll tell you one thing. There was a lot of talk around the time that Obama's budget came out, you know, criticizing him for not embracing Simpson Bowles or coming up with his own plan for reducing the deficit. And you know, I'm not taking a position here or there, but I will tell you the rationale that people on his team would give, or people on the Hill that supported him, said that it would have been destructive to the debate if he'd put his imprimatur on it, because the Republicans would have attacked it. So long as an idea is out there and hasn't been completely shot down, it's still a live possibility.
Right.
And you know, that may be true. That, you know, I don't know, but that's sort of the way people think about it, and why it's so hard to say, you know, what if. I will tell you, there was one point along the way in the debate on the CR that I thought was absolutely pivotal, that made it more long and protracted and contentious than it might have been. As you say, it's kind of seems like a trivial amount of money, but it turned into a bigger, more difficult thing to resolve, was the point at which when they had to do the first short-term CR to just keep things running while they worked out the deal, I mean, it was hard enough to work out the deal. But then they had to start fighting over the short-term CRs when the very first one, John Boehner said, well, I'll do another I'll do a stopgap, but we've got to have cuts on that too. I mean, that was a big departure from standard operating procedure on the Hill, which is while you're negotiating, you just have level funding, you don't make changes. And Boehner said, no, every step of the way we're going to be cutting. And that was a big deal. But it did make the whole thing more, longer, more protracted, and it made every step of the way a big debate.
I mean, I come back to the sort of strategic thinking by the parties in all of this that seems to constrain many of the opportunities for leadership. And I know that's something our next speaker, Senator Bennett, will have something to say, because he was very much in the middle of that during the first 2 years of this administration. We have time for one question before we move on. Who would like to pose it? John.
Thank you. Looking for optimism, as I said earlier this morning, you know, where is there the possibility for some solutions? And I heard something from Dan Glickman and also from David Wellner that it's the need to build trust among the members, and that good work gets done in the Senate, in the committees, because they know each other and they trust each other and they're willing to take more risk to compromise because of that. And of course, also, they're elected for 6 years instead of for 2 years. That certainly was Scoop's approach. He got a lot done before he introduced legislation, and then a lot done in the committees. Tom Foley, Speaker Foley, who's been mentioned several times this morning, was a protege of Scoop's. They lived here. True, they were from Washington State, and therefore it was harder to get home than if they were from New Jersey or from Virginia. But is there a way to create more trust among the members that can overcome ideology? And is there any possibility that with the Tea Party members who are so ideologically focused and who are, one of you said, like kamikazes, is there any possibility that building trust with the Tea Party ideology can lead to a solution?
Okay, Sarah.
It's a very good question, and I don't want to put a damper on the optimism. I guess I think of it in two ways. First, much of what Scoop Jackson was able to achieve in part was due to who he was, and part of is due to the times in which he was a senator. And sometimes it's hard for us to disentangle, right, how much contributed to that. But in a period where there's ideological overlap across the parties, it is relatively easier to come to some meeting of the minds. And put aside the question, at least for as much of that period with long, long duration of Democratic control, less expectation that something, what we do in Congress could help us win back control. And if in that period, we could see where there might be more meeting of the minds more often across a broader set of issues. I think the leaders still today have this dilemma of the difficulty knowing that playing to the base may help you, and that the base has an incentive, or the party has an incentive, because they can win back control, given that we've seen flopping of control of the two chambers.
Let's just take the example David brought up about health care. The president sort of resisted his Democratic members in the Senate and said, we've got to make an effort to try to get some Republican support. He went along with Max Baucus. There were extended negotiations, lots of amendments passed, and so on. But in the end, the signal from the leadership, and Senator Bennett can confirm or reject this, is that It said if we don't have the vast majority of the Republican senators and the whole body supportive, then don't agree to it. So in effect, there was a withdrawal from it. It was impossible to do, even though the leaders did what you were asking for, and it was because of the broader strategic position of the party, which was to oppose and defeat health reform in this time.
Yeah. Well, you know, I sorry to fuel pessimism here, but I actually think that the problem of getting people in Congress to work together isn't one of personal trust. I mean, I think there's a lot of mistrust here and there. So that I don't think it's, you know, kind of the idea that if everybody lived together and dined together and saw each other socially more, they'd, you know, be more inclined. There are just all these incentives and differences of interest and ideology going on. And sadly, I mean, I think the most likely inspiration to a big budget deal or something like that right now is unfortunately a really big, ugly external shock to the system, you know, kind of some problem in the market or something. Because, you know, over the last 10 years, one of the two times we've seen really big bipartisan action, it's been in the wake of 9/11 and, you know, when we were having a financial meltdown. I mean, that's a little bit more pessimistic than I really feel. But I do think that something beyond building trust is what Congress is going to need to address these big problems.
I have one more fairly negative assessment of things.
See what you brought on, John?
I think the moratorium on earmarks is something that many members of Congress may come to rue when they come to the appropriations process, because when members felt like they had a personal stake in getting an appropriations bill through because they had these earmarks for their home state, there was bipartisan support for a lot of the spending bills. And we're not going to have that this year. And so on the appropriations committees, you're not going to have people working together maybe the way that they did in the past. In fact, who wants to sit on an appropriations committee that's cutting spending now? I mean, it's not – you see people getting on who have almost no seniority at all. And I think that was, you know, for better or worse, it was a kind of a lubricant for keeping things moving in Congress. It wasn't that much money in the bigger picture, but it was something that gave a lot of people skin in the game that's not going to be there this year, and I think it's going to make it that much more difficult to get consensus.
I would like to ask you to join me in thanking Sarah, David, and Janet. That was terrific. Senator Bennett, as you may have gathered from the end of this panel, we haven't quite reconciled the issue of the sort of the relative importance, strength, possibilities of individual qualities, skills of political leadership and the constraints under which leaders operate now, particularly given the nature of the parties and the extent to which there are such strong views among core party constituencies oftentimes against doing the very things that we believe are necessary to grapple with problems, that is, talk practically about the problems and see if you can't work something else. Instead, it's a matter of strategic interest and the fervor back home. You have some experience to share with us and bring to bear on this. Senator Bennett was a superb member of the United States Senate, a member of the Appropriations Committee, the Banking Committee, the Joint Economic Committee. He has been known throughout his career as a man of extraordinary intelligence, wisdom, wit, and goodwill, actually has had a good deal of experience over the years in working across the aisle. He's been kind enough to to be here to offer some reflections on the subject of our conference, and join me in welcoming him, Bob Bennett.
Well, I came with certain things that I wanted to say, and as I sat here listening, I threw them all out and made a bunch of notes, and will do my best to respond for some of the things that I heard while I was here. First, when you talk about strategic thinking by the parties, you are speaking of something that does not exist. And to even bring it up as a possibility shows that you are a political scientist rather than a political realist. And we do not engage or indulge in strategic thinking. We just do our best to try to hold things together with some degree of coherence. You talk about Scoop Jackson. I knew Scoop Jackson. I had my first experience in the Senate when I was 19 years old and was serving as an intern in my father's office. To show what a junkie I was, I used to sit in the Senate gallery and listen to the debate. And when I was not doing that, I would read the congressional record to catch up on the debate. Now, if there's anything more dedicated than that, I don't know what it is. And in those days, there were debates on the floor of the Senate. I think television has ruined the debating process on the floor of the Senate because everyone is talking to the camera. Dick Durbin, I offer you as Exhibit A. Dick pays little or no attention to anything that his colleagues may say or do. But you notice the angle of his head while he's talking, and he is speaking to the television camera, and he does that very well. And when Time magazine picked its 10 best senators, predictably all of a kind that Time magazine would ideologically approve of, Time obviously went through a great metamorphosis when it came out from under the shadow of Henry Luce and came under the shadow of Hollywood. They picked Dick Durbin as one of the best senators and named him the debater. But to be a debater, you need somebody to debate against. And we don't do that in the Senate. You talk to the television camera. But in Scoop Jackson's day, there was debate. And the time as a young man getting my first taste of the Senate, I would listen to the debates. And it made a difference who was on the floor and what he was saying. I say he because there was only one she in the entire Senate, and that was Margaret Chase Smith, and she hardly ever showed up to engage in the debate. It was a very different Senate because the Democrats were split between the Southern Democrats, who were tremendously conservative, and the Northern Democrats, led by Hubert Humphrey, who were very liberal and continually frustrated. And the senator who controlled the balance of power in the period of time when I paid attention to the Senate was Everett Dirksen. Everett Dirksen wrote the Civil Rights Act. You give Lyndon Johnson credit for passing the Civil Rights Act, and that's legitimate. But I was there when it was done. I was a staffer in my father's office. That was okay in those days. It was not illegal to hire your son if he was ill-advised, unless he had a background and a understanding. I was my father's campaign manager, and we won the campaign, so it's appropriate that he took me into his staff. I was there, watched it happen. Bobby Kennedy was the attorney general, and his staffers would all come to the Hill, and they would talk to Dirksen's staffers. They wouldn't talk to Mike Mansfield's staffers because Dirksen held the balance of power. Goldwater was set to be the Republican standard bearer in the election, and Goldwater was against the Civil Rights Act. And Dirksen could have gone with Goldwater and killed it. The Democrats did not have enough votes to overcome the Southern filibuster without Dirksen. and all of the kinds of things, strategic thinking and cooperation and get along, stemmed from the fact that the Democrats were split. The Republicans, even though they only had 36 votes, controlled what would happen, what would pass, and what would not. And you had to get together across party lines. My father ultimately sided with Dirksen and against Goldwater on the Civil Rights Act. I helped him as his chief of staff with some of the ideas that I had. He paid for it with a very tough primary the next time he came around from the Utah coordinator of the John Birch Society. I ran that campaign too, and we won. Looking back on it, as I said in my farewell address to the Senate, which had, drew an unprecedented 30 senators, by the way, I was delighted so many showed up. Same thing, I voted for TARP and drew an opponent. And I was not as successful as my father at fighting it off. And so I have forced retirement, which I now am very grateful for. If I were up on the Hill, I would just be mad all the time. And I can sit down with the political scientists rather than the political realists and tell you what you should be thinking. And that's a great opportunity. All right. Enough. Let me go to some of the things I heard here and respond to them. The greatest scandal in American politics is not campaign finance reform. I believe that politics is divided between the great issues and the great diversions. And we spend most of our time arguing over the great diversions, and campaign finance reform is one of the great diversions. If money could control the election, Senator Perot would be fighting against, or President Perot would be fighting for his seat against soon-to-be President Forbes, and nobody else would much matter. The great issue is gerrymandering. For the House of Representatives, the vast majority of them are not threatened for their seat except in their primaries. And the district lines are drawn so that every Republican seat is safe and every Democratic seat is safe, with some exceptions, of course. But the vast majority of them survive only if they survive their primary. And as a consequence, if you're going to get elected a Democrat, you have to run to the left to win your primary, because only the activists vote in the primary. If you're a Republican, you run to the right. And so California sends us Bob Dornan and Nancy Pelosi. And her seat is safe, and his was, until he got so wild that he finally lost it. But how many seats are in play in the House of Representatives out of 435? 20? 25? The House of Representatives is not what the Founding Fathers had in mind. They made it a two-year term so that it could be responsive to the people. It is the least responsive body that we have. When Ronald Reagan won his landslide victory over Jimmy Carter in 1980, he brought the Senate with him, but he didn't bring the House. Why? Because Senate lines cannot be redrawn. And you get genuine elections in the Senate, but you don't in the House. And if I can give you one nugget to demonstrate this, after the 2000 redistricting, I said to someone who was involved in it on the Democratic side, I'm a little surprised that California didn't pick up more Democratic seats than they did as a result of the redistricting, that you didn't use that opportunity to cut out a few more Republican seats. He said, we could have, but if we were going to do that, we would have lost some of our incumbents. The seat would have stayed Democratic, but the incumbent would have lost in the primary. Particularly, Henry Waxman and Maxine Waters would have been replaced by Hispanics if we had redrawn the line for maximum Democratic advantage. So we drew the lines to protect Henry and Maxine. Is it any wonder that Henry Waxman and Maxine Waters are the least likely to compromise on anything or deal with any Republican when they are representatives for life? And the same thing happens to Republicans. You have the same problem where the district lines are drawn. So if you want a crusade that's going to change the House of Representatives in a way that will take it back to the Scoop Jackson era, crusade for district lines drawn in the House on something other than political lines. And when the Supreme Court ruled that you could draw a line for political purposes in order to make sure that African Americans got some House seats, the lawyers in the first Bush administration Justice Department said, this is the way we make the solid South Republican. And they did. So Cynthia McKinney gets elected in Georgia, but all of the voters who might cause other people in Georgia to think twice about taking very strong conservative positions because they had those voters in their district, all those voters are corralled into Cynthia McKinney's district. And, of course, the only challenge to her has to come from a Democrat. Earmarks, I heard earmarks mentioned. Earmarks is one of the great distractions, one of the great diversions. It's no amount of money at all, but it is tremendously important constitutionally and culturally. Constitutionally, the bedrock position of the Founding Fathers was the separation of powers. And they gave the Congress the power of the purse, thinking the Congress would be the dominant of the three branches. They gave the president the power of the sword. In case we went to war, we would have one leader. And they gave the judiciary life tenure so the other two branches couldn't mess with them. And increasingly, we have seen the Congress get weakened as the power of the purse runs down Pennsylvania Avenue and ends up at the White House. And the only vestige of the Congress exercising its power of the purse and saying, we get to decide how money gets spent, is earmarks. So what do we do in the name of defending the Constitution? We say, we'll let the president decide how everything gets spent. There should be more earmarks, not less. Sorry, Wall Street Journal. You track the expenditures of government by the number of earmarks. You track the irresponsibility of government by the number of earmarks. Look, in this year we just had this many, and now we've got this many. So naturally, we're spending out of control. Nonsense. The more earmarks, the more responsibility. Let me tell you what it's like without earmarks. Before Congress started to assert itself and exercise its power to determine how the money was going to be spent, it all came down to the White House. I was in the Nixon administration. I was on the receiving end of those phone calls. This is the way it works. Mr. Bennett? Yes, sir. Congressman? Glad to hear from you. That's a lie, but all right. Glad to hear from you. What can I do for you? Well, Mr. Bennett, you're aware that I sit on the Appropriations Committee that controls your department's budget, are you not? Oh, yes, Congressman. I'm very much aware of that. Fine. There's a project in my district that I want funded. And here it is. And if it's not funded, the next time Secretary Volpe comes before my committee, he's going to have a very hard time. Thank you, Congressman. I appreciate that very much. Walk down the hall, say to the budget director, we got to fund this. He said, why? It's terrible. I said, I know it's terrible, but we got to fund it. Here's why. Oh, okay. With an earmark, that congressman has to put his name on it, has to put it in the paper, has to defend it. You get rid of all the earmarks, and the phone calls will come down, and everything in Chicago will get funded, and everything in Wilmington, Delaware will get funded, and anybody who comes from a Republican district will not get funded, and the Republican will stand up and say, aren't I pure because I didn't ask for any earmarks? And I say, yeah, you're pure, and the vice president and the president really appreciate it. And then when they come to me and say, well, you're my representative in Congress, and this really makes a whole lot of sense. And I say, yeah, it really makes a whole lot of sense. And I've taken the earmark pledge. I never took it, obviously. And that's one of the reasons I'm not there. I've taken the earmark pledge, so I'll help you out to get what you need. Here's President Obama's phone number. You call him, and good luck. But that's one of the great diversions, and we've swallowed it. All right, what are the great issues? I've talked about gerrymandering from a political standpoint. The great issue we face is the economic issue. And I want to put it in slightly different terms than we usually hear about it. I don't care if somebody comes to me and says, the debt is so big, and the debt is so big, and it's so much per child, and it's going up so much per second, and so on. And I say, that doesn't make any difference. I want to know, how big is it compared to GDP? How big is it as a percentage of the economy? And more specifically, that number you can give me. This number you cannot, but we have to be aware of it. What is the national debt as a percentage of the national borrowing capacity? That's not a number we can come up with any precision. But the United States of America has the size of the economy, GDP, and with an economy as big as ours, we have a borrowing capacity in addition to the size of our GDP. And you put those two numbers together and you say, all right, it's X, whatever X is. Now, once we get to the point where the debt exceeds X, we're Greece. We're Portugal. We're Ireland. We're Zimbabwe. As long as we're this side of the line, wherever that line is, we're okay. Now, the debt as a percentage of GDP has been as high as 150%. When? You're the think tank. When was the debt 150% of GDP? 1946. We survived that. Because we knew it was not going to keep growing. That once we got over the war and stopped funding the war, it would come down. And it did. Partly because we weren't funding the war, and partly because, quite frankly, we inflated our way out of that problem. But we got it under control, and we survived. Now we are approaching that line, wherever it is, in peacetime. Oh, you say we got a war in Afghanistan. So that's peanuts compared to World War II. And the driver behind our approaching our ability, ultimate ability to borrow, is entitlement spending. And everybody has known that. Forever. This is not a new revelation. Paul Ryan is not the first one to point it out, even though you would think so from the editorials that are being written about it. I ran for the Senate in 1992, and I used some rather unorthodox language in talking while I did it. For example, I said, Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. And we have to do something about it. And we have to do it now. This is 1992. I got elected. So my first meeting, strategic thinking by the parties, I sat down with my fellow Republican senators, and we know, what are we going to do? So forth. I said, we've got to address Social Security before it runs us over the cliff. The senator who was sitting next to me stood up, walked around the table, and took a seat as far away from me as he could get. And he said, I don't even want to be in the same room with you while you're talking like that. Ronald Reagan talked about that back in 1986, and we lost control of the Senate in the next election. All right, when I was chairman of the Joint Economic Committee, we held hearings. I came up with a solution to Social Security. One of the witnesses, a Democrat, Bob Posen, got me on the road of that. I sat down with him. We worked it out. We got some other things. He didn't have a 100% fix. He was about an 85% fix. We fiddled around with things over about a six-month period. We came up with a 100% fix for Social Security, submitted it to the Social Security trustees. They vetted it, came back and said, yes, this is a 100%. This will fix Social Security in perpetuity. And I went to McConnell and I said, this has got to be the Republican position on Social Security. He looked at it and he says, Bob, absolutely. As soon as you get your first Democratic co-sponsor. Well, I never got one. I trolled across the aisle. I did everything I could. Bob, it's a great idea. Bob, this one wonderful comment. One fellow said, senator said to me, you know, you really know this stuff. You could be staff. So, he said, we're going to do it. Bob, this is right. I said, look, take my name off of it. Do whatever you want. But this is what we've got to do for the country, Social Security. Social Security is the easy one. Health care is the hard one. Social Security, easy. He said, we're going to do it right after the next election. Well, that's the problem. The next election never comes. Now, they did sit down after President Obama was elected and said, okay, we're getting serious. Come in, tell us your ideas, so on. And I went in, I laid the thing out. Yep, that's great. Okay, we're going to do it. And just one thing we want to change. And I said, what's that? Knowing in advance what it was. He says, we got to add a tax increase. I said, okay, you're Democrats. I understand that, and I'm out of here. Because that's what's got us in this problem all along. We keep promising more and more benefits, and then how are we going to pay for them? And then we put in that tax increase, and then the demographics change, and then we're stuck. And this thing, no. If you're going to add a tax increase, I'm not here. Well, we're going to do it without you. 2 years ago, Social Security is off the table, nobody talking about it. Paul Ryan's raised it. Democrats are demagoguing it. And we're right back where we were in 1992 when I ran the first time, which means we're right back where we were in 1986 when Ronald Reagan was talking about it. We're 30 years later. And we knew 30 years ago we had to do this. And we didn't. And as I say, Social Security is the easy one. Health care is the tough one. Medicaid is going to bankrupt the United States and every state in it simultaneously. Great line out of Lamar Alexander when we were debating Obama health care. He said, well, we should put a provision in this bill that would require every Democrat senator, or every senator who votes for it, that meant every Democrat, every senator who votes for it, to go home and be governor of his state and try to run his state budget under the terms of this bill. Because every state will be bankrupted by what this is doing. That coming from a man who was governor of his state. The Democratic governors agreed with him. The press didn't make a big deal out of it, but the National Governors Association was appalled at what the Obama health care plan would do to state budgets. I was presumptuous enough to send President Obama a memo after he got elected. I said, look, I have no standing. This is tremendously presumptuous and really pushy on my part. Okay, now let's get to it. This is a Nixon goes to China moment for you. You are inheriting an economy that is in serious trouble. And if a Democratic president says, let's do something about entitlements, and follows through, you will build enough political capital that you can then do anything you want in health care or the environment or anything else. But it's the entitlement spending that's going to destroy us, just the way it's the entitlement spending that did what it did to Greece, the entitlement spending that did what it did to Ireland, and so on. And it's the Democrats that have always won the election by demonizing the Republicans for bringing it up. So a Nixon goes to China moment. The president was kind enough to call me after he got the memo and thank me for it and say nice things. But he didn't get to it, and he made strategic planning. He made an enormous strategic mistake, and I'll end with this and then answer any questions you might have. instead of attacking the great issue, which is we are approaching the point where we will exceed the borrowing capacity of the United States. And if you don't think that's serious for a big, well-functioning, prosperous nation, go talk to the people at General Motors. With a big, prosperous, well-functioning company, but they kept borrowing money, and then suddenly they could not get out from under it. They were the paradigm of what happens to you when you're big and prosperous, but you exceed your borrowing capacity. The president decided he was going to do health care. All right, fine. I was into health care. Ron Wyden and I were working on a health care bill. We went down and talked to the president about it. They sat down in the White House and they said to themselves, I have this from one of the folks who said it, we're not going to make the mistake Hillary made. Hillary wrote the bill in the basement of the White House with nobody watching. So when it came out, no one had any ownership. The Congress wouldn't buy into it. It ultimately died of its own weight. It did. Hillary Care was not voted down. It just collapsed. Nobody ever voted for it. It just died. And nobody liked it. So we are going to be smarter than that. We are going to let the Congress write the bill so that they have buy-in. Reach out to Bennett. I got a phone call from Tom Daschle. I got visits from Nancy Ann DeParo. Reach out to the other Republicans. I said, look, I'm with you. Let's do this. This is the biggest entitlement. We've got to bring health, got to do the health care thing right. Oh, that's wonderful. I said, I want this to pass with 70 votes in the Senate, which meant you had to get 20 Republicans to vote for it because they already had, 10. I guess they had 60 Democrats. They said, oh, that'd be wonderful. You know, we could pass this bipartisan 70 votes. All right, we're going to let the Congress write it. And they laid out some general guidelines. Well, you know how binding and powerful general guidelines are? It's like spaghetti. And that meant, okay, here are the general guidelines. Now, you write the bill, and as the Senate was kind of gearing up for it, Nancy Pelosi said, wow, we get to write this bill? Henry, what do you want in this? So Henry Waxman and George Miller and Nancy Pelosi sat down, and they produced a bill that was a total disaster. And now the cement is hardening around that disaster. And the president, you know, I like him. I admire him in many ways, but he just didn't understand how bad the House is. And the comment that I got from somebody close to me says, we didn't understand how much the House hates the Senate. You know, Obama and Biden are both senators, and the mantra in the House goes all the way back to who? Sam Rayburn? You know, the Republicans are the opponent, but the Senate is the enemy. And, boy, they wrote a bill that is just terrible. So it gets over to the Senate, and we have to start from complete scratch. But the House has already got the buy-in, the sense of ownership, that the White House was hoping they would have around a piece of perfectly awful legislation. So what are we going to do in the Senate? Well, then all this wonderful, let's bring the Republicans in. I get sat down by a senior Democrat and says, we really appreciate your interest in health care. Now butt out. We're going to write the bill to suit ourselves. So they start writing the bill, and Teddy Kennedy's committee, and Kennedy's off in Florida. Teddy's off in Florida because of his illness. So Chris Dodd, who also happens to be chairman of the banking committee, has to do double duty. And then Max Baucus is saying, no, this is going to be my bill. So the jurisdiction is going on. And, you know, the decision to stay out of it and let the Congress write it is beginning to look like a really dumb decision, because it was. There wasn't the kind of leadership out of the White House on either the House or the Senate that said, this is not just guidelines, this is what we want to do. If we want Bennett in, if we want Lamar Alexander in, if we want Judd Gregg in, those are people that were co-sponsors of the Healthy Americans Act, otherwise known as Bennett-Wyden, or in Oregon, Wyden-Bennett, let's get them in. And Max Baucus, if you don't want him in, too bad. I'm from the White House. This is what the president wants, and we want them at the table. When Daschle called me, he said, absolutely, you will have a seat at the table. And then the presidential leadership disappeared. I didn't have any kind of seat at the table. I didn't even have a tweeter sitting in the back of the room telling me what was going on. None of us did. Republicans were completely frozen out. And as the bill emerged in the Senate, and it was a better bill than the House bill, but it was still a mess, you had Democrats looking at it saying, I can't vote for it. I can't vote for it for this reason, that reason, whatever. At which point, Bill Clinton comes to the Democratic conference and says, you know why we lost the election in 1994? Because we did not pass Hillary's health bill. Vote for this, no matter what it says. That was his message. The Democrats will lose the next election unless you vote for this. And David Axelrod goes on television and says, I know the president's numbers are down, but the day the health care bill passes, they will jump up 8 points. And we all look at each other and say, what's he smoking? So Harry Reid come up with 60 votes. Well, nobody is better at coming up with votes than Harry Reid. That's why he's the leader. So he goes to Mary Landrieu and says, Mary, you hate this bill. I hate this bill. Okay, what is it going to take? I got my checkbook out. The number was $300 million for Louisiana, the Louisiana Purchase. And then the Cornhusker kickback. We had fun naming all of these. The best moment was Barbara Mikulski when one reporter said to her, is there anything in this bill for Maryland? And she said, no, because I didn't know the bazaar was open, and stepped onto the elevator. Harry put together the 60 votes, and they passed it. And the president numbers went down, and the Tea Party movement was born, and Bob Bennett lost his seat. TARP probably had more to do with it, health care, but because I had co-sponsored a health care bill with Ron Wyden, the Club for Growth comes into Utah, Bennett Care, equivalent of Obamacare, you're in favor of a government takeover. The thing was a total disaster of congressional relations. Now, I'll wind up by saying I think the president learned something out of his first 2 years, just the way Bill Clinton did out of his first 2 years. And I think you're going to see more coherence coming out of the White House. I spoke to a high-level administration official who clearly does not want to be quoted, who's saying things are a lot better now that Bill Daley is the chief of staff. But that's what makes politics so interesting and makes your job at Brookings secure. Constantly something to analyze and something to look at it. Just think about this. Big issue, the great issues and the great diversions. And Brookings' mission should be, as Scoop Jackson's career was dedicated to, identifying the great issues and looking past the great diversions. Thanks so much.
Thank you all for coming. We've had a rich and interesting, informative morning. I I felt the juices flowing as Senator Bennett was talking. I was going to challenge him on any number of matters, and I was thinking Rashomon, the same story, but unfolding through different eyes and views. But that's the great thing, the kind of discussions and debates that we have here, and. He has really enriched our conference, and I thank him very much for coming, and I thank you all for coming. We are adjourned. Bye-bye.